This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
G'day, thanks for downloading the Hope Mornings Weekly podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. This week, we remember the great comedian and movie actor Robin Williams. Gary Yak, who worked with Robin Williams on Happy Feet 2, is going to share some personal insights into their time together. A new study has found there's still a stigma attached to doing IVF. We'll find out why that is and discuss surrogacy in the light of the controversy surrounding baby Gammy. A legal company run by the Salvos has taken out the Australian Law Firm of the Year. We find out why. Channel 9 journalist Tracy Vo shares her story of growing up in Australia as the child of Vietnamese refugees. What does the government's data retention plan mean for everyday people? Will the government be monitoring all our phone calls and internet? Andrew Morris, our new media manager, explains. And our TV reviewer, Mark Hadley, is pretty excited about the new working dog comedy, Utopia. Finally, we meet UK singer-songwriter Ryan Keane, who's touring Australia with Kate Miller-Heike. That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. Robin Williams was a unique talent in the world of comedy and Hollywood. He had a string of hit movies in the 80s and 90s, from Good Morning Vietnam to Dead Poets Society, Good Will Hunting and Mrs. Doubtfire, to name a few. But one of his more recent projects was as the voice of Lovelace on Happy Feet 1 and 2. Aussie comedian and filmmaker Gary Yak was one of the co-writers and voiceover artists who worked with Robin Williams in Sydney. G'day, Gary.
G'day. Hello, Katrina. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. You must be feeling pretty gutted about this.
Oh, yeah, it's just such sad news. And even sadder that he was so sad. I don't know about you, but pretty much I grew up with Robin Williams on TV and film. And so he's kind of a part of your life, even though, you know, at the time I didn't know him.
Did you have a sense of that sadness? I mean, when you worked with him on Happy Feet 2, what was the process like working with Robin Williams?
Well, he seemed to be in a really good place then. I mean, he was with his new partner, and about a year later they ended up getting married, and I think he'd been out of rehab for a while. And no, it was almost the complete sort of opposite. But when you see Robin, there's a real, because I'm a comedian as well, and I see it in other comics, there's this, you just catch them when they're on their own, sort of a sadness in their face. There's this vulnerability to him a little bit. There's something deep inside, but I think that's what makes him so amazing, so interesting, and such a great actor, because he brings that vulnerability and unpredictability to his performances.
Is there sort of perhaps an occupational hazard of reaching such heights and performing, you know, so intensely on stage and kind of being in those moments where I guess everything is heightened, that then the lows are also lower?
Well, it's true, and you're only as good as your last gig, is kind of what we say in the industry. And so even though he's probably had a string of amazing hits and amazing run, you know, if he looks back at the last thing he did, he probably focuses on that. And if that wasn't a success, then you're not a success.
It's funny that someone who's achieved so much could still have that fragility about their confidence and their sense of self.
It's incredible. I mean, it's hard to explain. And then, look, a lot of performers, a lot of actors, you know, a lot of comedians are like that. You know, they're constantly sort of doubting in themselves, but in a way, that's what keeps you sharp, and that's what keeps you interesting.
Tell us a little bit though about I guess the genius as well. You were working in a studio with him as one of the script writers. You know, you'd probably wrestled with words for hours on end, and then Robin Williams would, I imagine, just come out with things. He was sort of known for that. What was that like? Yeah,
I know, it was amazing, and we would obviously just encourage it because, you know, we're sitting there going, oh, what gold can Robin Williams come up with today? And, you know, he would always give us what we'd written, and, you know, we worked hard at writing that too, so it was, you know, it was pretty solid what we'd already written, but he would then always riff off that and go on tangents, and he was always amazing. I was just completely stunned at how he could do rhyming couplets. Like, you'd just throw him a word, and he'd turn it into this poem, this rhyming couplet poem.
It's amazing.
Starting off from one word. And just incredible, the words that he would choose and rhyme with. And he'd have everyone in stitches. And it was hard because we're all sitting in the one open room. So all the voice actors are in the one room, and we're sitting there with them. So you can't laugh. You've got to try not to laugh. Otherwise, it's going to cut onto their microphone. So, you know, you're looking around the room and everyone's, you know, biting their teeth, trying not to laugh. But, you know, and he was always switched on when he's working, in the sense that if you said something, oh, hey, Robin, why don't you try saying it like this? Or what about this line? He'd go, yeah, great, 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 great. And he'd jump up and you know, is the mic on? Is the mic on? And the mic was always on. And he would just, it was like his brain was already ahead of him, and he had to sort of make sure his mouth had caught up and he didn't want to miss out. And he'd sort of jump up and he'd sort of let it all out, and then he'd, you know, riff off that. And then he'd sort of like, finally he'd sort of relax and go, oh yeah, that was great. That was great. And
did he bring that energy to the whole room?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. But you know, at the same time, he was a kind of a quiet sort of guy. Like if you talk to him one on one, he was very softly spoken.
I'm speaking with Gary Eck, the comedian and filmmaker who worked with Robin Williams on Happy Feet 2. I understand he actually came along to one of your comedy gigs, Gary. That must have left you completely a wreck, nervous wreck.
It was really, I mean, it was exciting and exhilarating and scary because initially I didn't invite him down. He sort of invited himself because I'd invited the American comics who play the Amigos, and I said, look, why don't you come down and share my... Do you want to share my spot? Because I'm doing a headline spot at the Sugar Mill Hotel, and they just turned to Robin and said, hey, Robin, come on down.
Oh.
And he went, oh, okay.
You're like, no.
And, yeah. And Elijah Wood invites himself because they were all going to go out for dinner. And so they cancelled their dinner and came to my show. So, I'm crapping myself because I'm thinking, oh, no, if I die in front of Robin Williams, this is going to be awful. And I'm thinking, oh... But luckily, it was a packed room. There was, you know, heaps of people, so it was almost impossible not to do well. Cause there was a real energy and in the room, and everyone was anticipating. They could see Robin was there, and they weren't sure whether he was going to get up. Everyone's going, is he going to get up? Is he going to get up? And all the comics are like, I don't know. And then there's this American. I'd introduce this American guy called Jeff Garcia, who plays Ronaldo, one of the Amigos, and he's a really funny guy, and he's making fun of Elijah Wood and making fun of Lord of the Rings, and you know, and Elijah is sitting there and he sort of heckles back, and Robin Williams is sitting next to Elijah and he starts doing Gollum, he starts from Lord of the Rings going, my precious, and the audience just, you know, they know it's him, and they just erupt, and there's this roar in the room, and it's too late now, he's got to get up. He can't not get up. And so he starts walking towards the stage and still doing Gollum, and he gets up onto the stage, and Jeff Garcia is there, and he sort of just turns and says, ladies and gentlemen, Robin Williams, and gets on and does like a 35-minute impromptu set, you know, obliterates, of course. And it was the most incredible thing, though, was afterwards he actually came up to me and said, oh, look, thanks so much for letting me do that.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, wow, you're thanking me? I think you'll find it should be the other way around.
How did you feel after that?
It felt like a real organic show that everyone was involved in. You know, everyone sort of did really well. And even though he was the sort of, I guess, the main attraction at the end, it did feel like a kind of like a ensemble.
Yeah.
And I think that's what made it so electric and so amazing. And it was a real high. Like, I've only had two real highs in my comedy career that you can't sleep that same night, and that's the first time I did stand-up, and that was that night I did with Robin Williams.
Mm. Yeah, it must have been an amazing experience.
It was, and it was just, it was so kind of humble, and I think he turned up, like he came down to support, right? And he thought, I'll just support the guys, and you know, because he's a comedian and we're comedians. And then when he, you know, maybe he was just checking out to see, you know, is it a good room? You know, they're going to be like four people sitting in the audience, and it's not going to get up if there's, you know, no one there. But, of course, the room's packed and there was so much energy. It was almost... He's a comedy addict, so I don't think it was going to be no chance of him not getting up.
Yeah. Well, finally, Gary, I guess as a fellow comedian, what do you admire about Robin Williams?
Look, I would... On so many levels, really. I mean, his ability as a comedian and his improv and the way he sort of just... can think, like, you know, I do a lot of ad-lib with the audience, but the way he can just say, take a topic and make that go for 10, 15 minutes. And then, you know, I really, really admire his acting ability. He's one of the few comedians, I guess, that have traveled over to dramatic acting and do it really well.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Gary, for sharing your thoughts and experiences today.
No problem.
It's been a real insight. Yeah, that's Gary Eck, filmmaker and comedian, talking about his relationship with comedy and movie great Robin Williams, who passed away yesterday. Each year, around 12,000 babies are born as a result of fertility treatments. However, a survey for a new fertility clinic in Sydney found that 85% of women still feel that there's a social stigma associated with having IVF. Professor William Ledger is the head of the School of Women's and Children's Health at the University of New South Wales. He's also a fertility expert at IVF Australia. Good morning, Bill.
Yeah, good morning.
How common is it for couples to experience infertility?
It's sadly more common than many people think. If you define it as trying for a baby for a year without getting pregnant, then about one couple in six will have that level of problem.
Yeah, so that's very common. So why is there still then a stigma associated with doing IVF?
Well, I think go back a step, because the stigma starts really within families quite often. You know, people decide to have a child. It's one of those lovely bonding moments in their life, and then it doesn't happen. And frequently, hints begin to get dropped from mom and dad and the sort of older generation about wanting grandchildren, and then maybe the younger brother or sister gets a pregnancy going, and people then begin to not talk about babies and children in front of that couple because they think they might upset them. So there's an aura begins to develop, and that's upsetting.
Do you think there's sort of a sense of failure wrapped up in that?
Exactly, that's what transmits to the son, the daughter, the brother, the sister, if you like, that within the family they're not in a way doing their bit. And then they sort of pluck up courage and go and see a doctor, often a GP, who you hope would be sensitive and understanding, but that's not always the case. And so they can be knocked back further there if we're not careful. And then eventually they kind of accept that, yes, there is a problem, we're going to have to do an IVF. And many people, certainly more than half of the couples doing IVF, don't even tell their close friends, their work colleagues, their boss at work. So the reality is that many people try and keep it a secret, which I think shows there is a stigma attached to it.
Wow, you said more than half don't tell anyone that they're doing IVF. Do you think people will talk about it more openly, you know, if they have a baby, you know, a successful pregnancy?
I mean, that's the thing, that if the pregnancy gets as far as about 3 months, then it's likely that the baby will be healthy. At that point, many women will tell their friends and family that they're pregnant. And if they've been trying for a long time and people know that, then it's more easy to talk about having the IVF because they've got the success, if you like, and the kind of stigmas behind them. The people who are less well off are the ones who've tried 3, 4, 5 times no pregnancy. They do tend to keep it secret, and our counsellors tell us how damaged they can be by that, you know, level of secrecy and the pain they suffer.
What would help to reduce that sense of stigma or being abnormal in some way? I know that at you know, where you work at IVF Australia, there's counselling and things like that that's provided. But what do you think we could be doing to reduce that sense of stigma or failure?
I think we're getting there because people are more open now than ever about talking about fertility, and IVF is in the news all the time. So it's good to be open about things, and that's certainly the advice we always get from our counsellors. So we are moving in the right direction, but just maybe encouraging families to be a little bit more supportive, maybe slightly less judgmental when their son or daughter or brother or sister is known to be trying but not succeeding, being open and discussing things. And I think also if people are a little bit more willing to talk more freely with their GP and their specialist, because we're there to help and we can point them in the right direction if they let us know they've got a problem.
Yeah. I mean, even the language we're using, we're talking about trying. We're talking about having a success, aren't we? We're talking about an IVF round failed.
They're words I try and teach my juniors not to use in this context, because it's not as if you as a person, it's not like you're running a race and you come second. It's your body who's letting you down, and often there's nothing much you can do about it. So you're absolutely right. These words like failure are truly stigmatizing.
I'm speaking with Professor William Ledger. He's the head of the School of Women's and Children's Health at the University of New South Wales. We're speaking about the fact that there's still this stigma associated with IVF. Now, while I have you here, Professor Ledger, I feel like I need to ask you, there's been such a big interest in surrogacy and all the issues around it because of the baby Gammy story. What do you think we can learn from that very sad and difficult situation?
I know. Well, firstly, let me say what a tragedy it is for everybody involved. Obviously, the little baby himself, the surrogate mom, and also the couple in Western Australia. There's nobody coming out of this with a win. It's clear that it's a very sad, tragic tale. what it says to me is that the regulations in Australia are muddled at the moment, and that people are having to go overseas frequently for surrogacy, for egg donation, in order to do things in their own family life that they're not allowed to do in this country. So I think it might be a useful prompt to make the regulators and governments sit up and think, is there a way that we might change the rules to make it better to do things in Australia where we can regulate it more?
Are there ways that are known to work better with surrogacy? Are there sort of limits that you think work to make surrogacy a less risky kind of proposition?
I think so, that if it's done within a legal framework in a developed country like Australia, taking great care of the surrogate mom, making sure that her rights are respected, also taking great care of the rights of the child, then I think we could have less of these catastrophes. It's always going to be an emotionally challenging area. For one woman to carry a baby for someone else for 9 months is an enormous thing, whatever they're doing it for. So it's got to be managed with great care. It's got to be managed with input from professionals, counsellors, as well as doctors, nurses, and people who are able to manage it properly. And I think, therefore, that if we had a system that allowed a moderate amount of money to be paid to a surrogate, not hundreds of thousands of dollars, but, you know, compensation for all the time that she's going to lose and all of the physical challenge she's going to go through with pregnancy. If Australia let us do that, then people wouldn't have to go overseas so much. And also, in this case, just about every fertility doctor in Australia would have put one embryo, not two, and we wouldn't see the large number of twins that we get back from these overseas clinics, which create a lot of problems.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for sharing your point of view with us this morning.
Okay. You're more than welcome.
That's Professor William Ledger. He's the head of the School of Women's and Children's Health at the University of New South Wales, and he's with IVF Australia. Now, our good friend here at Hope Mornings, Chris Witts, who we hear from each morning at 9 a.m, has let me know that the Salvo's legal team have won an important industry award. Luke Geary is from Salvo's Legal. G'day, Luke.
Hi, Katrina. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. So tell us about your award. What did you win?
Yeah, it was a bit of a surprise to us. Friday night last week, the Australian Law Awards were held in Sydney at the Four Seasons Hotel. So it was kind of a big gala affair for all the top lawyers in Australia. And, Salvo's Legal was named the Australian Law Firm of the Year, beating out five other contenders from billion-dollar-a-year turnover law firms. This small church-owned social enterprise law firm got to show them what we're made of.
The Australian Law Firm of the Year. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Well done.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're all very excited.
And so I understand that your service is quite unique, that you're really the only church-based legal service. Is that right?
We're actually two law firms which are both owned by the Salvation Army and run by the Salvation Army. And the two companies essentially represent a social enterprise model where there's one company called Salvo's Legal, which is just like any other commercial law firm in how it looks. That is, you can, for example, if you wanted to buy or sell a house or have a will done, or if you're in business, you wanted to have some contract advice or help with a big deal, as in property deal or a commercial deal, we could be the lawyers, and we charge you a fee like any other normal law firm would. The only difference is that all the money that we make, that is all the fees that we receive less our expenses, get distributed to another company. And that company is called Salvo's Legal Humanitarian. And Salvo's Legal Humanitarian is a free law firm for people in need. It's essentially like a legal aid service which practices in the areas of crime, family and children's law, debt, housing, Centrelink and migration and refugee law. And all the work that it does for those clients, those people in need, is entirely funded by the work of the commercial legal fees generated by Salvo's Legal. So it's a free social service for people who need a lawyer and can't afford one, but it's not funded by government or by Salvation Army donations.
That's amazing. And so why did you win the award? Did they give you any feedback as to what you'd done that stood out or anything like that?
Well, simply, it's because we're the best of the best.
Wow.
I guess we don't know precisely what the judge's assessment of our firms was, but ultimately it considers things including revenue, people and culture, the values, the contribution to the legal profession, client feedback. So we had a number of our clients. So we act for some very large institutional clients. We act for the Commonwealth Bank. We act for community sector banking, which is a joint venture between Bineo and Adelaide Bank, and 20 not-for-profits providing banking and financial services to not-for-profits across Australia. We act for the New South Wales government and the Commonwealth government in terms of a lot of property law work. And so we had feedback from clients who gave testimonials in support of the service that we offer. But also, of course, as a law firm who doesn't generate profit for the partners, it's kind of hard to disagree with that. So I think that the models that we have really resonated with the judges, and they saw that the creation of justice for people in need was kind of hard to ignore.
Well, thank you for telling us a little bit about what you do and what you offer. I honestly had never heard of the service before, so it's great to let people know about it.
Thanks, Katrina. For anyone interested, go to our website, salvoslegal.com.au.
All right. Thank you so much. That is Luke Geary from Salvos Legal. That website is salvoslegal.com.au.
Thanks, Katrina.
Although she's still very young, TV journalist Tracy Vo has already had a wonderful career in Australian TV news, thanks in part to the sacrifice of her parents. After the fall of Saigon, her parents escaped war-torn Vietnam on a leaky boat, determined to make a new life away from communist rule. Tracy Vo shares her family's story in her book, Small Bamboo. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Katrina.
Now, a big part of the book is telling your father's story, and I guess the way that the Vietnam War impacted on his family, his very large family. Can you give us a sense of what that time was like for your parents?
For my father, he enjoyed his childhood. I guess he said he was an extremely lucky young boy. You know, they had a big family. They all looked after each other. They had quite a big house, you know, what was considered a big house in Vietnam at the time. But it wasn't until he was about 12 years old that the war came close to his doorstep, that he could see just, you know, helicopters flying above, flares, rockets, gunfire, everything. And he was only 12, but he already understood, you know, what was going on. My uncles, his older brothers, were already part of the war. The oldest one, my uncle Three, we call them by numbers because it's such a big family. He was a pilot in the South Vietnamese Air Force, and every time he was able to come home, it was always a relief for the family because they knew he was safe.
Mm.
And Dad also was part of South Vietnamese Air Force, the training arm of it, and he was based at Tan Son Nhuc Air Base, which was the main air base at the time. And fortunately for him, he didn't have to fight. He was just training. But, you know, he did come under attack on several occasions because that was the main air base for the South Vietnamese.
And so what prompted them to get on the boat and to flee Vietnam? What happened?
That was on the minds of everyone in South Vietnam. They didn't want to be under communist rule. It was a very difficult life after that. Mum and Dad had to work on the black market. That's where they met, on the streets of Saigon. There was no way to really earn a stable living at the time. And also, you know, one interesting fact was the fact that the government kept changing the currency. So, you know, once people felt like they were on a level playing field again, that they would change the currency. So whatever you had, what money you had before was redundant. So they made it very difficult for people to just live a normal life. So, you know, Dad had several attempts to escape Vietnam, but they failed. You know, sometimes these plans don't work out. They get caught, or the organisers get caught, or it could just be a scam for people to take money off innocent South Vietnamese who want to escape, and they just run off with the money. So it got to the point where my uncle got so fed up, my uncle Five, he got so fed up that he took it into his own hands and organised it himself and bought a boat and all that, put a lot of money into it. And in 1978, they finally fled Vietnam.
And where did they end up?
So it was about a week trip on the ocean, and they ended up in Malaysia on one of the islands. At the time, you know, many nations understood why, you know, all the South Vietnamese were trying to escape. So they actually had set up immigration, I guess, stations on some of the islands there in Malaysia, one from Canada, one from America, one from Australia, and the other one from France. So my parents arrived there on one of their little islands there, Pulau Tenga, and they were accepted to go to Australia straight away. They were flown to Perth, and that's where they've been ever since.
I feel like I have to ask you, Tracy, as I'm sure many people do, how do you feel about the current politics around asylum seekers and boat arrivals in particular?
It's a very difficult situation or issue to solve. There's no silver bullet. We also must understand that the situation was very different for my parents compared to now. We've got a lot of asylum seekers trying to flee countries from all over the world to come to Australia. All I can say is I completely understand why they would want to, because Australia is a great country. And my parents say that every single day. They still are pinching themselves. They can't believe that they're here. And they get a lot of support from the government. You know, Dad's heading into his 60s now and he's getting the veterans pension and he's very grateful for the new home that he was able to come into 30, 40 odd years ago. I can understand why it can be, there is a tough stance. Sometimes we don't get legitimate asylum seekers or refugees. At the same time, I wish, you know, we could be a bit more generous like, you know, Australia was to my parents, because, you know, my folks always say that if they could open their doors to people in need, they would. Mm. And they just hope that other people can experience the generosity that Australia has given to them.
I'm speaking with Tracy Vo, the Channel 9 journalist. She's written her family's story in her book, Small Bamboo. Now, Tracy, did you experience racism as a child and do you still experience it today?
I did. When I was really, really young, it wasn't too bad. But when I got to six, that was the first time that really people had said I was different. I didn't really understand what the girls were saying. It was some other fellow students at my primary school, and they in fact said I had ugly skin. Mm. And that really tore me up, and I went home and tried to scrub my skin to make it lighter, and I didn't really like the olive skin that I had, and I would also try to stroke my nose so it wasn't so flat, and I looked at my eyes saying I wish they were, you know, much more open and wider. But
it seemed like that one sort of incident really had a big impact on you for quite some time.
Yeah, I didn't think it did at the time, but I carried that for many years. And you try to block it out, but it did carry on for a very long time. It just crushed my self-esteem, I suppose, when I was at that age. And, you know, and you head into your teen years and, you know, those sorts of comments don't really help either. So, yeah. But it's not little comments like that. It's also the battle you have with cultures. You know, I was born in Australia. I am Australian, but I look different. And so I'm trying to battle within myself, where do I belong? You know, am I Vietnamese? Am I Australian? Am I Vietnamese Australian? What does that mean? So I've been through a lot of soul searching, I suppose, and working out where I do belong. But I know where I belong. I belong here. And I've just got an incredible heritage that I can brag about on occasion.
Yeah. I mean, there's a sense of you really embracing that Vietnamese heritage in the book. And it seems like, I guess, you've recently taken that on as a big part of your identity.
Yeah, that's right. I think there's a lot more appreciation for it. More people are fascinated by Vietnamese culture, and I get really chuffed when people ask me about it. And, yeah. You know, you look at people like An Do and his brother Qua, who've really broken down those barriers as well. Like, people love An because he's just as Aussie as anyone yeah. else, and he's got that brilliant humour to carry him through. Doing what I do as well, I hope that I can break down some barriers. And, you know, I know my bosses at Channel 9 are very supportive of where I come from, but they don't look at what I look like. It's the job that I do. And that was one of the fears I had as well, you know, trying to get into commercial television and as a journalist. And, you know, you have those fears. But when you've got great management and people who aren't, who are very open-minded, then I think you've got, you know, for me, there was nothing to worry about.
Mm. And so just finally, what parts of your Vietnamese background and culture do you really cherish? What for you is the most precious part of that?
Family values within the Vietnamese culture are very strong. We carry a lot of respect for our seniors as well. I think, you know, I guess doing the job that I do, you see a lot of people out there. And I was having a discussion with some colleagues a few days ago, just talking about the lack of respect that some people have for older people and that sort of stuff. And it really breaks my heart. Within my culture, we were taught that from the get-go, you know, respect. You should respect your elders, important. But also, for me, I think the biggest thing for me, and it might sound a bit funny, but the food.
Yeah.
The food is just wonderful. I love cooking, and it's my therapy. And the fact that I've got that sort of cuisine within me and that I can actually make these wonderful dishes for people, I think that's really important too. And that's a really big element in family, because we have these big meals and then we have all these family gatherings, and it's always surrounded with food. That's what brings us joy. So I think those two things are really important in our culture.
Well, thank you so much for sharing some of your story with us today, Tracy, and congratulations on the book.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That is Channel 9 TV journalist Tracy Vo talking about her book, Small Bamboo. Still to come on the Hope Mornings Weekly podcast, we'll meet singer-songwriter and UK surfer Ryan Keane, who's touring with Kate Miller-Heike. Mark Hadley reviews the new Working Dog TV show Utopia. And what will the government's data retention scheme mean for you and I? In the last few weeks, the government has flagged plans for a compulsory data retention program, which would require telephone and internet service providers to store your metadata for 2 years so that it can be accessed by law enforcement agencies if needed. Now, this is a big shift from just monitoring suspects or people of interest in a crime to monitoring all citizens. The government says the scheme is needed to combat the threat of terrorism. Andrew Morris, our new media manager, is here to explain what this new data retention scheme is all about. G'day, Andrew.
G'day, Katrina. Well, yeah, well, we've had Tony Abbott explain it. We've had George Brandis totally stuff it up.
Yeah.
And then Malcolm Turnbull came out and reasonably did a good job of clearing up the what metadata and all that kind of stuff and how the government's plan would work in practice. So
can we start with that?
With
what is metadata? Because I think the first thing people think of is that, you know, all their phone calls and all their internet is going to be monitored. What's the reality of the situation?
So most people would say, particularly who are planning this plan, would say that it is the it's the information about the communication. Okay. Rather than the content in that communication. So we're talking about how you made that call, where you made that call, all that kind of detail, rather than what you actually said in that telephone call.
Okay, so the kind of stuff that would come up on your phone bill, number and...
Yep, so we're talking about telephone numbers, the time and length of phone calls, the IP address of the computer which you are receiving messages or sending messages, the location of the parties making the phone call, email addresses to and from, the visitors, the log of visitors that were in a chat room at that time, the status of chat sites, the start and finish times of internet sessions. So all that data about what you're doing, except what you were looking at.
So it's not the content, it's just the bare bones of who was where at what time kind of thing.
Yeah. So if the government had a problem and they knew that there was activity happening on Facebook that they don't like or they wanted to investigate more, they would need to go to talk. They would need to say to Facebook, hey, we believe there was some activity happening on Facebook that we are suspicious of and we need to investigate. Can you give us the IP address of the people that were doing that stuff?
Oh, wow. Okay.
So they give them an address. They then have to find that. They've got that address. They then trace it back to the ISP, the company that the people were using, and they have to then ask the ISP company, can you please tell us the IP address of the person that was using it at that time?
A lot of parties involved.
There's two parties at least involved that they've got to find information from.
Okay, but this is a big move because, you know, previously just suspects or people of interest in a crime have been monitored. This is kind of monitoring all activity. That's a big jump, right?
So there's been legislation and there's been retention of information. Companies retain information for business reasons already, and under special circumstances and warrants and all that kind of stuff. You know, our police agencies and security agencies can ask and access that data. So yes, it has existed. The British have had rushed a similar kind of legislation through their parliament. The European Union has ruled it invalid. I believe, from what I've read, the US does have it, but they are winding it back a little bit, whereas we're now going forward into it. So look, you know, the government's got its reasons. You're probably going to ask me what one of the main objections to all this. I mean, all the companies like telcos and IPs saying this is going to cost a fortune.
Yeah,
and so there's figures of hundreds of millions of dollars going to be spent.
So who pays for it then?
Well, and it's obviously they're not going to pay. Well, they're going to pay for it, but they're going to pass it on to the consumer. You know, and the government can say, well, it won't be passed on to the consumer, but it really will be. So, yeah. I mean, so, yeah, so cost of implementation is a concern. Privacy is the number one. Like, really, they're not going to know where I visited. They're not going to know. And now, the government has ruled out that they're not going to have your browsing history. They've already cleared that up because of the vague statements that George Brandis and Tony Abbott made. In fact, it wasn't vague. He said, oh, we'll have your browsing history. Turnbull and that came out and said, no, that's not what we're doing. So they've retracted that already. So privacy, you know, does the government really need all that information? Mm. You know, don't they already have too much information about us as it stands? So privacy and the cost of implementation are the big concerns, obviously.
All right. So we need to wait and see now how this all goes when they try and get it through Parliament in a couple of months' time.
Yeah. I mean, they're not having a lot of success with their budget plans at the moment. They've got a few issues on their mind.
So it could all come to nothing. All right. Well, let's try not to freak out about it too much, but it's good just to at least clear up what it is and what it isn't. So thanks for that.
In terms of it does seem like it is inevitable that it will happen. Like, it's pretty sure that it will happen in some form. It's just, you know, how much information they'll have and for how long and all that kind of stuff.
All right. So the details to be nutted out. Thanks, Andrew.
Pleasure.
That's Andrew Morris, our new media manager. We've been talking about the government's new data retention plans.
You added a community garden.
It's a couple of swings and a seesaw.
That's a community playground.
Then what's a community garden?
Well, they're like, you know, big vegetable patches.
What for?
So people can grow their own produce.
Why would you do that?
It's supposed to foster a sense of neighbourhood, social cohesion.
That rings a bell. Social, what was it again?
Cohesion.
That's the phrase the interviewer used.
What?
When he was talking to the planning minister about it on the radio.
The radio?
The Radio National, but the response was amazing. Inbox full, people applauding us, wanting to get involved, and Stephanie Alexander, two missed calls.
I don't think there's a place for a community garden.
There must be somewhere we can squeeze in a couple of tomato plants.
Hope 103.2 Mornings with Katrina Rowe.
The Culture Collective.
It's one of the best movies I've seen for ages.
Really fun series, but it's got a great underlying message.
Guaranteed 8 out of 10.
Utopia is the latest TV offering from Working Dog, the collaboration responsible for Frontline and The Hollow Men and the movies The Castle and The Dish. It stars Rob Sitch as Tony, the CEO of the newly created Nation Building Authority. First episode went to air last night on the ABC. Our TV reviewer, Mark Hadley's on the line. G'day, Mark.
Hey, how you going?
Not bad. Did this work for you, Mark, Utopia?
Yes. No, I've been waiting for something like this for a long time. It's so good to see satire as good as this coming back to the Australian airways. I mean, the good thing about satire is basically it puts something in front of us that we can recognise, then ramps it up to a crazy enough level that we believe it could actually happen. So basically, Rob Sitch and his team are responsible for taking care of every large government promise that's supposed to, you know, fit under the heading of nation building, and what in the end turns out some really exquisite white elephants. I don't know. Did you get a chance to see some of it?
I did. I watched it last night. I actually couldn't help thinking there was a Yes Minister influence, you know, where everyone's really busy but nothing actually gets done.
Exactly. Or for that matter, like the real complications of life set in and the grand ideals just sort of fall to the floor. In the end, in the first episode, for those people who might have missed it, they were seeing and it's also available on iView, by the way, really would catch it up if I were you. You basically see them trying to deal with this urban development and someone accidentally mentions that it should have, sustainable gardens and so community gardens, and this somehow takes over the entire project so that, you know, now the PR is far more valuable than the actual project itself. And that is believable to us. You know what I think is also believable to us is the failure of these great projects to really mean anything. Because deep down we know that it's not a harbour bridge or, you know, an opera house or anything else for that matter that really defines us as a nation. I mean, these things can symbolise who we are, but they don't define us. You don't build a nation through this. You know, in fact, to be honest, you build a nation through character, not concrete. And I think that's the sort of thing we look at this and we go, in the end, this building doesn't really mean who we are as Australians. But interestingly, you know, if we're going to try and confront things like asylum seekers and stuff like that, you know, great questions of our age, we don't say, well, let's build a better detention centre. We actually say, let's come up with a human response, what the Bible calls righteousness. you know, and you see it every time the government suggests, or any government, doesn't matter whether it's Labor, Liberal or otherwise, suggests something that isn't really amounting to righteousness. You hear people talk on the radio, doesn't matter, secular or Christian, about our loss of opportunity as a nation or our character.
Yeah.
It's not concrete that's going to help us. And that's the laugh behind utopia, that you can't find utopia in concrete and you won't find an Australian character there either.
It is good. I mean, there's a lot of other shows in this kind of genre. You know, there's the workplace comedies, The Office, the Parks and Recreation. But this is, there is that uniquely Australian vibe to it as well, that just brings it a little bit closer to home and makes us a little bit more able to laugh at ourselves, I think.
I think so, because we have this sense of, you know, we're a comparatively young nation, and so we have this sense, I believe, still in, you know, in our makeup of excitement, of character, of desire, you know, to reach for something. But like I said, the whole program about utopia is, how do you get there?
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't know, utopia is this idea of the perfect existence, the perfect world, and you just don't get there, you know, through basically an architect's design.
Have you seen Beyond the first episode?
Yes, and look, I'm not going to give anything away. Okay. It gets better.
It gets better. Okay. That's good, because these shows often kind of start slower and then they really drag you in. That's good to hear, Mark. Thanks for the recommendation.
No worries.
That's our TV reviewer, Mark Hadley, talking about the new Working Dog production, Utopia, which launched on the ABC last night. If you missed it, maybe catch up on iView and be ready for next week. Singer-songwriter Ryan Keane is developing a reputation for his percussive style of guitar and his down-to-earth lyrics. In the mould of artists like Ed Sheeran, Passenger and Newton Faulkner, Ryan Keane's music sounds as full and rich live as it does on the recording. He's currently touring Australia with our very own Kate Miller-Heike, and they're playing in Sydney this weekend. G'day, Ryan.
Hey, how are you doing?
How's it going, touring with Kate Miller-Heike?
Yeah, fantastic. Really, really good, thanks. Really enjoying seeing the country. We've been all over already. Started down in Perth and across Adelaide and up to Cairns. So I'm getting to see a bit of Australia. It's fantastic.
And Kate's a bit of a character. Are you enjoying working with her?
Yeah, she's amazing. She's amazing. Unbelievable singer. She's inspirational to be around. And she did a duet with Passenger on her latest record and has got me singing that set with her on stage each night. So it's a real pleasure to be on tour with her.
Oh, it's beautiful. Now, these days, everyone wants to be a pop star, but you were originally planning on a career in the background of the music industry. What changed things for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was more just that I was very nervous, basically, to have a go at doing music, and it was after losing a friend to have a go at giving a go myself. It took a bit of a catalyst to get me going. I knew that I wanted to be involved in music, but I lacked the confidence, so I just sort of wanted to be involved any which way initially.
And you had a really big breakthrough when you were invited to go on tour with Ed Sheeran, but you nearly didn't make the tour. Tell us about what happened.
Yeah, so I foolishly tried to open a bottle of wine without using a corkscrew. And I'd done it before in the past, but this time it didn't work out so well. And basically, the bottle shattered, and one of the segments of glass severed my wrist pretty badly, and it cut through the tendons and everything. So I lost movement in my thumb, and I had to undergo some pretty full on surgery. You know, stitching up the tendons and stuff to hopefully get movement back in the thumb. And it was a bit of a difficult time. It was a 10-week recovery period, basically, and so everyone was telling me that I wouldn't be able to do the tour, but I was pretty determined to do so. So I ended up modifying the cast. You know, my arm was in, I melted a plectrum into the thumb part of it and sort of retaught myself how to play guitar with a cast on without the use of my thumb. And thankfully it sort of worked out, and I got to do the tour, and it sort of all moved forward from there, really.
Again, yeah, once you played guitar in a cast, it would have felt really light once you were free of that.
Oh, it's fantastic, yeah. It was great to be back. And I mean, there's still a bit of limited movement in certain ways with my thumb, but other than that, I'm pretty much recovered, so it's all good.
Oh, well, that's good. Now, Ed Sheeran is one of my musical heroes. I'm wondering who yours are.
I'm quite old school with a lot of it, to be honest. John Martin was a massive influence for me personally. More recent people, I'd say, would be Chris Martin, the early Coldplay stuff. I was very, very inspired by, or John Mayer, perhaps, as a guitarist and songwriter. Quite a few, really.
Now, you've been working very hard, playing a lot of gigs in the UK, Europe, Australia, even Texas. Where do you get the biggest response to your music, or do you feel like it really connects?
Things seem to be going really well in Germany at the moment. that sort of the touring all over the place is quite new to me. It only started happening really this year. I did a whole bunch of gigs in the UK. I've been doing hundreds and hundreds of gigs there and releasing EPs and sort of doing it the old school way, really, of just trying to build a fan base through gigging, getting a live reputation. And eventually I ended up doing my album, and since doing my album, that sort of opened the gateway, I guess, to doing releases in other countries. And so far, Germany's responded really well, and it's starting to pick up around Europe, and you know, I'm getting out to Australia here more now, so I'm hopefully out here too.
Yeah, has it been sort of a defining moment in your career, sort of one of those moments where you just really want to pinch yourself and you're thinking, this can't be happening, you know, this can't be real?
Yeah, quite regularly, to be honest. I mean, hearing myself on radio for the first time in the UK, that was pretty cool. And there's been a few gigs where I've been sort of a bit overwhelmed by it all. I've been lucky enough to do some pretty big supports, and some of those times have been incredible, or you know, selling out my first gig and stuff. There's a few sort of moments where you suddenly realise that you're living it and it is actually happening. That, you know, from way back in the day when I was playing, you know, pubs, you know, with sticky floors and terrible sound systems to a couple of local drunks, to playing, you know, huge arenas to sell out crowds is humbling and it's fantastic. So yeah, there are quite a few moments where I've tried to just absorb it and remember that it is actually happening.
It must be a nice feeling.
Yeah, it's great. It's really, really good.
Your song "Old Scars" that has that catchy chorus that talks about going back to the ocean, and do you grew up in Devon? Now there's some pretty spectacular coastline down there. Do you have a favourite place that you like to go back to just to chill out and regroup?
It's good to hear an Australian knowing that Devon's beautiful as well. I tend to sort of say, you know, I'm down on the beaches in Devon, and I think people sort of laugh a little bit.
Oh, I'm thinking
beautiful the beaches are here.
I'm thinking Exmoor and Dartmoor and places like that are just amazing.
Have you been?
Yes.
Oh, great. Yeah, no, yeah, I go up to Dartmoor a lot, and down to the coast there. I mean, surfing in Devon, I've been for more Shallowbrook probably, when I just go to sort of just chill out on the beach, there's a few beautiful ones around Tallcross area, and there's a place called East Prawl. There's some wonderful spots.
Okay, so do you have a favourite? Like, we're obviously biased here in Sydney. Like, we think our beaches are the best in the world.
Yeah.
What would Ryan Keane vote for if I said, hey, favourite beach in the world?
Favourite beach in the world? Oh, that is a tough one, you know. I went out to Hawaii a few years ago, and I've got to say, North Shore Hawaii was... That was mind-blowing. That was probably up there, I'd say.
All right. Well, we're not going to go to your concert now. You're supposed to say something in Sydney.
All right, fine. I'm going to change it and say Manly Beach.
Awesome. All right. Thank you, Ryan. Well, I do hope you enjoy your time in Oz, and we're looking forward to seeing you this weekend in Sydney.
Yeah, please come down. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. You. All the best with it.
Nice one. Thanks so much for having me on. I'll see you soon.
Yeah, that's Ryan Keane. He's supporting Kate Miller Hikies Tour. They're playing tonight at Chatswood Concourse, tomorrow night at Joan Sutherland Performing Arts Centre in Penrith, and at the Illawarra Performing Arts Centre on Tuesday, August 26. All right, and now here is Old Scars on Hope 103.2.
Take me high above the ground, up above the city lights. Better this way round, and please don't let me down. I'm closer than I've ever been. I believe it's coming now. With these old scars and this old guitar. We might move slow, but we'll go far. Going back to the ocean, back to where I'm from. Cause every time I try to forget her, I just can't move on. Cause when I felt her heart, is when I felt at home. I'll go up above the clouds, higher than I've ever been. And I'll never come back down. Just lose me in the sound. Cause I know no other way. I believe it's coming now. With these old scars and this old guitar. terrible fun. 'Cause when I felt her heart, 'cause when I felt at home. Every time I try to forget her, I just can't move on. 'Cause when I felt her heart, is when I felt at home.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.